Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Nicole Chung discusses her memoir, All You Can Ever Know, with fellow writer Rebecca Mackay. This conversation originally took place November 27, 2018, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
With that said, I would like to introduce our guests tonight. One of the central themes we address at the American Writers Museum is identity. Who we are, how we decide who we will become. One of the most profound accomplishments of writing is the way it creates authority, the right everyone has to tell their own story. In All You Can Ever Know, Nicole Chung writes about her adoption by white parents, her search for her Korean-American birth family, and about the unspoken truths and undercurrents between people trying to see one another as clearly as they love one another. The book was named one of the season's best and most anticipated books by The Washington Post, Entertainment Weekly, Time, Vanity Fair, Elle, and many other publications. Nicole's essays and articles have appeared in The New York Times, GQ, Slate, Longreads, BuzzFeed, and Hazlitt. Among many others, she is the editor-in-chief of Catapult Magazine and the former managing editor of The Toast. Here in conversation with Nicole, as well as Rebecca Mackay, author of the novels The Great Believers, The Hundred Year House, and The Borrower, as well as the short story collection Music for Wartime. She is artistic director of Story Studio Chicago and a recent nominee for the National Book Awards. Welcome to you both, and thank you.
Thank you. All right, so the way we're going to do this, we decided, is we're going to talk a little bit, and then I'm going to subtly segue into an invitation for her to read, as if it were unplanned, and then we're going to talk some more.
Which I will accept.
And then we'll open up. I have restrained myself from gushing about your books so that I can gush in front of everybody.
Great.
And say, so, you know, I just finished it a couple days ago because I want it to be fresh. You know, you get it in the mail and you're like, oh, I want to read this right away. And like, the event's 3 months away. That's probably not a good idea. So I just finished it. And I was so taken with this as an example, among so many other things, of the ways that a very specific idiosyncratic story, you know, where, you know, you'd be really hard-pressed to find someone with a story identical to yours, right? This really idiosyncratic story becomes universal, becomes relevant to everyone when you dig deep enough on the thematics, when you really, it's not about the details of what happened, it's about what it means. And all these explorations of identity, belonging, heritage, secrets, discovery, things that are going to be relevant to most families, right? So the first thing I want to ask you about is, you know, as you sit down to write this story originally, I'm assuming you've been thinking a lot about those concepts in a kind of a heady way, because you're a thinker. You're not like a random person that some stuff happened to and then you said, I better learn how to write a book. Mm-hmm. You're a writer. So when you went in, did you know thematically what your book was going to be about? Did you write towards those discoveries, or did you go in, knowing in the end what the bigger takeaways would be?
I think yes, I did. I did go in knowing that obviously it is a very personal story. It's just my story. It can't possibly represent like all Asian Americans or all adoptees, especially, but. I did, you know, one of the benefits of memoir is that I knew the scope of the story. I knew whereabouts things would begin, what I wanted to cover, and how the story ended. Like, I didn't have to make something up. And so in that sense, yeah, the bigger things I had to think about were these thematic questions. Where are the different, where does the movement in the story come from? Like, what's going to sweep people up and keep their interest and make them keep reading? Like, what are they going to be able to take away, given that, of course, they don't share my exact experience? And what I was thinking about from the very beginning, even before I really thought I'd write a book about all of this, when I first started just writing sort of essays, like telling the story piecemeal, I really relied a lot on what seemed to strike a chord with readers, like what people came back and had questions about, or what they said to me about, you know, like, I'm not adopted, but in my family we have like this particular estrangement or like this particular secret. There's this thing that we never talk about, and every time I press, people just shut down. I was really interested in like what makes people keep kind of like gently, lovingly, but consistently pushing on those points of tension or just secrecy within a family, because as we all know, plenty of people are actually fairly content to let those things lie, and then there's certain people who really feel the need to keep pushing. And I realized in my mid to late 20s I was one of those people, and that was what kind of spurred my decision to search for my birth family. But I think that curiosity, that sense of there's this thing we don't talk about, whether it's a topic or a person or an event, I kind of started with those big questions. What were the big questions I had? How could I make those real to readers? How could they look at that and think about their own questions about their families and their identities? And again, just the things that we're not always so comfortable talking about.
That actually, I want to follow up with a question about readers, yeah. Which... I think that's something that all of us have to face at some point in drafting, right? The first draft is maybe much more for yourself, but then you're trying to calibrate, is this understandable? Have I made myself right. clear? Is this boring? Is it confusing to someone who's not literally me? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, I'm sure that for a memoir, that paradigm shift is especially dramatic, where this is stuff you've been chewing on for longer than most people chew on a novel before deciding to share it with the world. This is your life. And I'm curious, I guess it's a two-part question. I'm curious how that shift was. And then I'm also curious how you envisioned your readership. And I'm partly curious because, you're someone who comes very much from the literary world. As an editor, you're very much, you're part of, literary Twitter, things like that.
Am I?
Yeah, you are.
Take your word for it.
Right? This is a book. I'm curious if you saw this book going out to kind of the esoteric literary memoir readers, or if you saw what I think seems to be happening, that it would reach a much wider audience, and were you thinking about approachability and all of that? You sort of calibrating yourself to a certain audience.
That's such an interesting question. I'm going to answer the second one first because it's freshest in my memory. I was not thinking about I wasn't worried too much about who it would reach. I think that's a question that the industry thinks and worries about for sure. So one of the first things that happens when you have a book idea, and I don't think I'm spilling big trade secrets here, one of the very first questions is about marketability. Who's the audience? Who's going to read this? And I do remember getting some questions I felt were surprising a little bit, because one person was well, what's the audience beyond adopted people? Or what's the audience beyond Asian Americans? And I just thought that was so interesting, because as an Asian American, I have always read widely, deeply outside of my experience. I think that's why most people read. But also, I just didn't grow up reading any books by Asian American writers at all. And I still grew up reading and loving books. So it didn't even occur to me that that sounds very naive as I say it. So I did eventually have to kind of wrestle with that and eventually just kind of stop worrying about it. I'm trying to tell a story, trying to tell a true story. I'm going to try to tell it in a way that people can access, even if they're not me or not adopted or not Korean. And I have to kind of just trust that, I think readers are interesting and interested and curious and brave. And I think readers will follow writers into all kinds of different experiences and different territories. I think that's why we read. So in that sense, I didn't worry too much about that. The shift, you were talking about initially, the first part of your question, between taking something that is so personal, that at first you are kind of writing for you and kind of translating it or thinking about it as an outside reader. I was helped by the fact that when I started writing about adoption in the first place, I was already kind of grappling with that, because it was adoption something I know so intimately. I don't know what it's like to not be adopted. So it wasn't too hard for me to access that and write about it. But from the beginning, I know that's not most people's experience, right? Many people are adopted or touched by adoption. I've heard from a lot of those people, and that's been really wonderful. But by and large, I knew I was writing for an audience that wouldn't necessarily get that the way I got it. So from the beginning, I really had to think about, how can I explain this in a way that doesn't slow down the narrative, in a way that gets across what it was like, or at least was like for me, but still allows the story to move forward without a ton of explanations at the beginning. But I always knew that was going to be part of it, and it was even folded into my first draft a little bit, just because that's how I've always told these stories.
I'd love to talk, because this is your first book, mm-hmm. and I think it's always really interesting to see, I won't ask these questions. The audience might have questions later about, you know, sure. how you got it published, things like that. But what I'm really interested in is what about this process surprised you? What would you not have expected, either about this book or about publishing books in general, but about, you know, that, and I'm thinking specifically about, you know, we were just talking about the difference between writing for yourself and writing for others, mm-hmm. but I'm always really interested in, this is the, you know, in at least in book length form, the first time in someone's life that it's not just the imagination of someone reading it. It's not just who would prospective readers be, but actually mm-hmm. taking it and turning it out from yourself towards the world. And I know some of that stuff you can anticipate, and some of it is, you know, kind of gobsmackingly unfamiliar. Right. So are there things that, either about just the theoretical part of it, of like, wow, it's not my story anymore, or just about the publishing process that surprised you this first time?
Again, like kind of working backwards, I knew always the book would go out into the world and books have a life of their own. I mean, it's still surprising to me when people come up to me and say, I loved your book. This is what I took from it. And I sometimes think, like, it's not that I think they're wrong, but sometimes they'll say things that surprise me and I'm like, oh, wow, like, that's not what I was thinking. But that doesn't mean that you're wrong, because of course you're bringing your own experience and your own questions and your own curiosity to the story. Like there was a review where, and it was a positive review, but a writer said that she thought the book was like a strong condemnation of like well-meaning like white people. And to be clear, like, that wasn't exactly why I wrote the book. But I don't necessarily think she's wrong if that's kind of one thing she took from it. It's just, it's interesting to see a book have a life of its own. And I think until it's out there in the world, you don't know what that's going to look like or how you will feel about it. I feel great about it. I really like that I like that some of the pressure's off. I'm like, it's out there. You all will take it and run with it. Like, that's delightful to me. And I like hearing about different things that people take from it. The writing process, a big surprise for me was, I think, as I'd alluded to, like, I knew how the story ended. I was not, like, trying to write my way toward an ending. Although I did write, like, four different endings because I wasn't sure how to end, like... Yeah, I did. And then that was kind of fun. I liked it. But in any case, but I knew, like, the basic events in the story. So it wasn't like that was a matter of suspense. I was not expecting... you know, that said, how difficult it might be to revisit and write about some of these things. And I thought... I was pretty well prepared for that, and I thought some of these things happened 5, 10, 20 years ago. I've dealt with this. I've processed this. Writing about this won't be super difficult. And sometimes it wasn't, and sometimes it really was. Yeah. So that was definitely... And then it changed. The writing about it, of course, changed like how I thought about these things and changed how I thought about some of the people. I think I went in with a lot of empathy and trying to understand each and every person in the book, maybe even if they make decisions that we don't agree with. Like, I was trying to understand why. It was not ever going to be about attacking anybody, really. It was just, I wanted to try to understand every person's perspective. And I think my, like, writing them and sometimes dwelling, like, in their perspective in the book really just increased my empathy for a lot of people.
I think that's one of the huge strengths of the book is that, you know, I think it's hard enough to write a novel with no villain, right? Not that you can't, I mean, not that you shouldn't, like, lots of great novels have great villains, but, to write a novel, I'm always impressed when someone's pulled off a novel where everyone's right, you know, like... Everyone's trying to do the right thing and there's still conflict, there's still something, let alone to do it with a memoir where these are real people who you have to... And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is you really, in addition to telling your own story, you are, in a few smaller chapters, telling the story from the point of view of your sister Cindy.
Right.
And it becomes clear in those chapters that, you know, this is a received story. You're not just imagining it. Mm-hmm. You know, she's confided this in you that you've, and it's interesting because we know, like, we get that narratively, like, they must have connected and become very close for her to know this stuff, which becomes the sort of narrative promise in the book. It's kind of cool. I'm really curious what that was like, both just artistically, writing from that other point of view, but also in terms of your relationship with your sister and the conversations you might have had around that?
Yeah, I was always kind of obsessed with, so I did meet my biological sister. It's like a minor spoiler, but not really, because she's introduced really early in the book. I was in love with this story she told about, like, and it's not altogether happy, but I loved the story she told about, like, the day that our mother was in labor with me very early, very unexpected, and went to the hospital and comes back and there's no baby. You know, and then, like, what does she tell my sisters? And, like, how do they deal with or not deal with or talk about or not talk about that? I was just thinking, my sister at the time was 6. Like, she has very few solid memories from this period anyway. But, like, she remembers that. And then she doesn't remember, you know, how they talked about it. And I was just really intrigued by that silence. Because I also grew up in a family where, for very different reasons, there were just things we didn't talk about, right? So I was interested, first of all, in introducing her as a character and her story, and our stories then are sort of unfold on these parallel tracks. And I think a lot of the tension in the first part of the book comes from, you know me, you know a little bit about her, you know at some point the paths will collide, but you don't know how or when or why, you know, how that happens. But I was really interested in just the different ways that, you know, silence was at play in both our families, you know, and the different reasons. And how that also makes the act of telling the story, telling her story and my story, like, very powerful and meaningful for both of us. I wasn't expecting to spend so much time in her perspective. You know, there are several chapters through the book that are. But I just found I really liked writing in it, and I had... You know, I had enough source material, I had enough information, and I wanted her to feel like I wanted her to feel as, like, alive and real and fully human on the page as, like, I did, because it did feel so much like our story and not just my story. Because in some sense, hers is the life I could have had. And when she was growing up wondering what it would be like to be in another family, when she met me, it was a sort of answer to that question. And I wanted those two narratives to almost be in conversation with each other until we meet and they merge. So the best way to do that was to give her, like, full, like, I guess, agency and get, kind of be in her perspective, which I was able to do because she was so generous and open and, like, wanted me to tell this. So
that's lovely. Well, and talking about that, you know, the way that you build tension at the beginning, I think that's... you've done something really tricky where you start to tell your story and you don't come out with, like, the huge teaser of, like, you know, what, just wait, something crazy lies ahead or anything like that. You kind of drop subtle hints that the story is going to get really interesting. But you do it in a really light-handed way that really draws people in. And speaking of that, would you be willing to read your opening?
Oh, sure.
How did you like my segue, you guys?
I'm totally shocked. Yes. All right, this is what I think of as the prologue to the book. The story my mother told me about them was always the same. Your birth parents had just moved here from Korea. They thought they wouldn't be able to give you the life you deserved. It's the first story I can recall, one that would shape 100 others once I was old enough and brave enough to go looking. When I was still young, 3 or 4, I've been told. I would crawl into my mother's lap before asking to hear it. Her arms would have encircled me, solid and strong where I was slight, pale and freckled against my light brown skin. At that age, a shiny black bowl cut and bangs would have framed my face, a stark contrast to the reddish brown perm my mother had when I was young. I was no doubt growing out of toddler cuteness by then. But my mom thought I was beautiful. When you think of someone as your gift from God, maybe you can never see them as anything else. How could they give me up? I must have asked her this question 100 times, and my mother never wavered in her response. Years later, I would wonder whether someone told her how to comfort me, if she read the advice in a book, or heard it from the adoption agency. Or if, as my parent, she simply knew what she ought to say, what I wanted to hear. The doctors told them you'd struggle all your life. They were very sad they couldn't keep you, but they thought adoption was the best thing for you. Even as a child, I knew my line too. They were right, Mom. By the time I was 5 or 6 years old, I'd heard the tale of my loving, selfless birth parents so many times I could recite it myself. I collected every fact I could, hoarding the sparse and faded glimpses into my past like bright favorite toys. This may be all you can ever know, I was told. It wasn't a joyful story through and through, but it was their story and mine too. The only thing we'd ever shared. And as my parents saw it, the story could have ended no other way. So when people asked about my family, my features, the fate I'd been dealt, maybe it isn't surprising how I answered. First in a childish chirrup, later in the lecturing tone of one obliged to educate. I strove to be calm and direct, never giving anything away in my voice, never changing the details. Offering the story I'd learned so early was, I thought, one way to gain acceptance. It was both the excuse for how I looked and a way of asking pardon for it. Looking back, of course, I can make out the gaps, the places where my mother and father must have made their own guesses, the pauses where harder questions could have followed. Why didn't they ask for help? What if they'd changed their minds? Would you have adopted me if you'd been able to have a child of your own? Family lore given to us as children has such hold over us, such staying power. It can form the bedrock of another kind of faith, one to rival any religion, informing our beliefs about ourselves and our families and our place in the world. When tiny traitorous doubts arose, when I felt lost or confused about all the things I couldn't know, I told myself that something as noble as my birth parents' sacrifice demanded my trust, my loyalty. They thought adoption was the best thing for you. Above all, it was a legend formed and told again, because my parents wanted me to believe that my birth family had loved me from the start, that my parents in turn were meant to adopt me, and that the story unfolded as it should have. This was the foundation on which they built our family, and as I grew, I too staked my identity on it. That story, a lifeline cast when I was too young for deeper questions, continued to bring me comfort. Years later, grown up and expecting a child of my own, I would search for my birth family, still wanting to believe in it.
Thank you. So you had toward the end there of what you read this lovely meditation on family lore. And I was reminded as you read that of how you start on that note, and then that really comes full circle at the end of the book when you're talking about your own daughter and the stories that you're able to tell her. It gets a little bit into heritage and, you know, learning Korean and things like that. But in addition to that family lore, she now has a book that she can hold in her hands, right? It's funny because we have daughters, I think, right around the same age, yeah. And like mine's 11, yours is 10 and a half. And I mean, my 11-year-old is not going to read my massive novel about AIDS in Chicago. That's not going to happen for a little while.
Not yet.
It's like a lot of gay sex. There's all kinds of stuff in there that, like, we'll wait a little. You know, there's not that temptation, but I think I know kids that age are so curious. I could imagine her really wanting to know what's in this book. And I'm, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about how you've talked about the book with her, how you've introduced her to this idea of what this is, her role in all of it?
Sure. My role with pretty much everybody in my family, not just my kids, was I don't really want the book to be the first time that you hear something about, like, our family or about, you know, in my daughter's case, like, I guess, your birth, because I was pregnant with her, and that was one of the reasons I decided to search for my birth family. It was this idea of I mean, practical things like I didn't have a medical history, and that suddenly felt very important. But also, you know, I didn't feel like I had a history, like a I don't know, like a culture or a connection to pass on to her. I just was thinking, well, I had all these questions as a kid. Like, she'll have all these questions. I don't have answers. Is that really good enough for her? But anyway, so my rule was, I wanted to talk with her about everything in the book before we read the book or before she read the book. And I did that with everybody, basically. We'd already talked about like all the topics, so nobody was like shocked to find anything. In my daughter's case, it's funny because, you know, we had talked about the one remaining piece of the story she didn't know were just some of the traumas in my birth family. And so we talked pretty frankly about that, and then we read the book together. The book is appropriate for 10 and a half to 11 to 12-year-olds, in case you're wondering. There's like, it's interesting, I didn't write it that way on purpose, but then when it was a Junior Library Guild pick for like, I was like, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense, that's great, okay. So yeah, I was very excited. I'm like, now I've written a young adult book. Like, goal checked. But yeah, so we read it together. And
when you say you read it together, what do you mean?
Oh, like, we were reading it. So she doesn't need me to read to her, but right. We still like to read together. So, I mean, we read it, like, through together.
Like, you're reading aloud to her.
Yeah.
And she's listening. That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah. It was really neat. And so it was both deeply painful as a writer to read my own writing out loud for that long.
Once it's done and you can't change anything.
I was like,
awesome.
I was like, I just saw a typo. I'm just going to, just hold on, sweetie. I'm going to email my publisher. And then I'll be right back with you. That was kind of mortifying. But overall, it was like obviously it was very moving to get to share that with her. I would, you know, at the end of every chapter, I'd be like, any questions, you know, just like checking up. And it was funny too, because at the end of every chapter, she'd be like, that's such a cliffhanger. Like, what happens? Can we read another chapter? And I'd be like, that's very flattering, but you know how the story ends. Like, you know, this is our life. So I know you're angling for like a later bedtime, but like, I think
the flattery approach.
It was really sweet, and also it was just very funny.
Oh, cool.
But it's been really nice to have this like tangible thing. You know, she also wanted the ebook. So in addition to like the many hard copies that we have, I got her the ebook. And she like was annotating it, and she highlighted the dedication because it says like for Cindy, who's my sister, and our daughters. And she highlighted it and was like, "That's me. I'm Nicole Chung's daughter." I was like, "I should sell your annotated version. Like that would be great. That would be really unethical, but it would be really funny for people."
Oh my god!
So it's been a mix of like touching and hilarious, and you know, a little awkward at times to share. But again, like, I feel like this is her legacy too. Like, it's very much her story and the story of our family. And, you know, in particular, some of the parts about my sister and her daughter, who's, you know, my daughter's only cousin, you know, they've always known each other. They've always been part of each other's lives. They don't know, or they wouldn't know unless we told them, like, everything we had to do to kind of put our family back together so that they could have an aunt, an uncle, a cousin. I wanted her and now my younger daughter and my niece as well just to understand, like, what kind of just the steps we went through, the fact that we didn't grow up together, but we do have this close relationship, and it's because we decided that we wanted it to be that way. And as a result, their family looks different, you know, than it would.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
that's great. I'm curious about your name. It's something that you get to at the end, you know, sort of at the end of the book, right? But not completely. And for me, maybe you want to explain so that I'm not putting words in your mouth, but it's not the name you grew up with. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of the book, you're getting into maybe, you know, some embracing of this name. But there's also always that question for writers of what name you choose to publish under. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, if you can talk a little bit about that.
So going by Chung and taking back my birth name. So it's the name on my original birth certificate. I was born, my birth name was Susan Chung. My Korean name was Soo Jung. And you know, I wasn't really ready to like claim that or any part of it really for a while. It was a few years after a reunion, after I reconnected with my birth family, where I started to think, What one thing I really wasn't comfortable with was, like, I didn't want to just kind of, like, and I still don't really feel like I have a right to say, like, this is, like, I'm not trying to assert that I belong in your family or that I'm a fully fledged, you know, I'm not trying to say that I'm, like, really your daughter in that sense. Like, for me, taking my birth name back was very much about having a Korean name, like having that link to my heritage. My kids having the option someday, if they want, to incorporate some aspect of, you know, our Korean heritage into their names. I like a lot of women who write online, I get a lot of harassment. And another reason I've just been really glad to publish under a different name than my kids is it's a different name than my kids. So I never talk about, like, their last name anymore, and I'm very glad it's different for that reason. Originally taking the name, and it was even before I really started writing a lot or publishing a lot, it was just a personal decision based on wanting to have this link to my Korean heritage. Having always had a name that wasn't Korean and having to explain that, like, over and over, I was like, you know, this would be actually pretty cool. I laugh, too, whenever I see it or people ask me how to pronounce it, because it's extremely easy to pronounce.
I'm assuming you grew up with a Hungarian last name like me. We both have Hungarian
fathers. It was really hard to... I don't talk about that either because of my parents and trying to protect their privacy. But yes, it was uncommon.
I'm not asking you to say it.
Oh, yeah. But it was uncommon. It was only 6 letters. Nobody could spell it. Nobody could pronounce it.
Same. Yeah.
Like, I mean, just they could not. So it was difficult. And then on top of nobody being able to pronounce it, I would then have to... Like, I remember a substitute teacher, like, grilling me about it while calling roll. And I ended up having to explain to him, like, I'm adopted. Like, I know, you know... Yeah. He was like, because you look Asian, like, kind of, I'm like, I'm completely Asian, you know? And we, like, had to do this, like, at the start of English class. It was just so awkward. So I had a lifetime of experiences like that. I laugh because the social worker who, my adoptive parents had to talk with before they adopted me, they had asked at one point, like, what my birth family's name was or something, and the social worker was like, it's like something foreign and, like, unpronounceable, which I think is hilarious and, like, super racist, but also, like, it's Chung, you know? It's really very easy to pronounce. So I know.
I write under Makai, which, you know, mm-hmm. is, again, 6 letters, Hungarian, mm-hmm. not very intuitive. But I legally have my husband's last name, which is Freeman. And it's always kind of a relief to give it at, like, the pharmacy where it's like, I can give my name and whatever. And every single time they're like, what? How do you spell that? Like, Freeman? Are you kidding me? Like, it's the one time in my life that I get to use this name is at the pharmacy and you can't spell. Yeah. Amazing. Okay. If you have a question card, I'm gonna pass it to the side. There are 2 questions here that kind of go together. And these are questions I'm sure you get a lot, so I'm sure you have an answer for them. The one question is, has your birth father read your book, and what was his reaction? And the other question is, did the fact that you knew that your family, however you want to define that, would read the book, having a chilling effect on your writing, were there things you didn't write about for that reason?
My birth father has read the book. Oh, well, actually, he's working his way through it. So Korean's his first language, and he is very fluent in English, but I think doesn't often read full-length books. And in particular, you know, it's a memoir, it's personal. I think he wanted to take his time. So he is almost done with it. But I sent it to him, like, months before it was published just because I wanted him to have a chance. I think he's been really positive. My birth father's actually a writer. I found this out after we reconnected. He's an essayist, which is, like, pretty interesting. And so he's also said he's just very proud and thinks that he's like, you got that from me. And I was like, okay, great, thanks, I guess. but it's just kind of funny. I think he's very proud. And I think in terms of, I'm sure parts of it were difficult to read. I mean, I do think it is like a very, I tried to keep it like compassionate and respectful. It was never about like, it was not about like spilling every family secret, and it was definitely not intended to be like a hit piece on anybody. I just knew there were things that he'd feel like uncertain about, so I did talk with him about everything I was planning on including. And I did that with my adoptive parents as well, and of course my sister. And it wasn't so much like I gave everybody veto power, but I did want to give people a chance to like correct the record if they felt I got something wrong, or say, I mean, nobody said this, but I was actually wondering if somebody would say, like, don't write about this particular thing, and nobody did. I think my adoptive father said, you know, one thing I thought was really very generous, which was that, you know, this isn't the book that he or my mother would have written about our family, but that's okay, because, you know, it's my memory, it's my perspective, and he really didn't feel like it was his place to, like, tell me what to say or how to interpret things, which I really appreciated. So I wouldn't say writing it, I wouldn't say it had a chilling effect. I always knew I was going to show it to them. I knew everything in the book would be things we'd talked about before. So again, no curveballs, nobody would be shocked. And I knew we'd have time to talk about it before publication, so that, you know, if there was any, like, longer discussion to have, we'd have it. But everybody has been really wonderful and really supportive. No one asked me to pull anything out or add something in or phrase anything differently. So yeah, I mean, honestly, everyone couldn't have been, like, nicer about it.
My own follow-up question, just out of curiosity. I know that sometimes with memoirs, certain publishing houses want you to legally clear everything with everyone. Did they ask you to have people read and sign off, or was it
so difficult? Because, like, how? I mean, memory is subjective. Like, it wouldn't even necessarily be like a lie if I remembered something differently than my mother remembered it, you know? And also there's, like, that tricky part of, like, you know, I think you can try to signal when you're not sure in a memoir, which I do sometimes, like, I'm not sure how old I was, but I think I was this age, or, like, I'm told, like, this. But yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows you're talking about the past, and memory is kind of a fuzzy, subjective thing. That said, like, legally, I think generally the rule in most, gosh, I mean, I don't want to be quoted on this on, like, the internet, but I think generally that if it happened to you, you're, like, considered the authority, and, like, it's at least not actionable, like, if it directly happened to you. Yeah. I think where you get into, like, legal issues are when it's hearsay. Yeah. So that's a pleasant topic. Yeah. Oh my God. Please don't sue me.
There's a lovely note here. I'll let you keep this one because it starts with this lovely thing about finishing the book last night and crying and feelings and all these things. It's very sweet. And then it says, for very different reasons, I've often felt alienated from my own culture in a society that values whiteness and encourages assimilation. What advice do you have for folks who are trying to relearn and reclaim their identities, racial or otherwise? How do you combat the imposter syndrome of somehow not being blank Asian, Korean, whatever, enough?
I wish I could give you a hug. I think that's such a good question and such a hard one to answer for somebody else, because we all come to this with our own baggage and our own scars. I think in my case, like, it took a very long time for me to think. Like, at the very beginning, when I first reconnected with my birth family, I feel like it would have felt like appropriation if I had immediately started using, like, my birth name, even though it wasn't just their name, even though it was my birth name, like, my original name. I think at first that would have felt like I didn't have a right. And I've had to kind of fight that feeling off and on over the years when I, like, try to learn something new, or, like, when I started taking Korean lessons, or when I try to talk to my kids about their heritage. Each and every time there's that little, like, sort of prickle of, like, oh, I don't really have a right to be talking about this. But I think my best advice, if you want to call it that, and I never feel super qualified to give advice, is just to try to, like, be very gentle and patient with yourself, and remember that you do have a right. Like, this is your identity. So, and nobody but you can figure out how to be, like, it's not like all, like, Korean Americans are the same, right? Like, there's a very particular type of, like, Korean American, or, you know, person that you're trying to be. And it's not a space someone else can occupy, so you're not taking it from anybody. My space as a Korean American who's adopted looks really different, right, than, like, my sisters, for example, who grew up in our birth family. But that's not to say that, like, I'm less than she is in terms of our Koreanness. It's just really different. I still struggle with this. I think I will always, to be honest, feel, like, a little bit insecure in that identity. So it's also okay if you feel that way. You're not alone in feeling that way. But if, you know, if exploring it and learning more about it is something you want, you know, don't let those feelings keep you from searching.
There are two other advice questions here that I'm kind of going to roll into one.
Okay.
Even though they're totally different, but maybe you can sure. you can and answer them together. One is, what advice do you have for an adoptee from another country from which records about the birth family are not available? And this person has a 33-year-old daughter who's interested in learning more about her birth family, or at least the tribe to which her, and I'm going to get the mestizo mother belongs. I'm sorry I'm not doing that word right. And then the other one is also about an adopted daughter, which is how best to help my daughter prepare and manage expectations when and if we find her birth family. What would you have wanted to help with all your questions? And this person's daughter is 9 and adopted from China.
So just taking that one first again, one of the things I really wish that I'd had, well, there are a few things, like in terms of what my family could have done. And I don't say this to cast stones, but like even the very idea of me searching for my birth family or finding them one day from my adoptive family was always seen as this kind of suspect. It was something they were very wary about, which I understand the reasons for, but that meant we couldn't really even talk about the possibility someday, like far off in the future, that I might want to search. It was just kind of like, well, yeah, if you want to do that when you're older, you know, you can. And that was kind of the extent of it. So the end result was I didn't really know if it was possible. I didn't know what the process involved. I knew I couldn't really talk to my adoptive family about it, at least without a lot of like awkwardness as a child. And so, you know, one of the things I wish is just that that had always been an open conversation that was on the table. And that also, I think a lot of times when we talked about my adoption, you know, I was the one who brought it up. And I think that in a way that makes sense because of course they weren't thinking about it all the time like I was, but I think it's good if you're not always waiting for the child to bring it up, like a signal that it's a fine conversation and that it's always an open topic is to bring it up yourselves as parents, right? So that it's not, the burden's not always on the child. The other thing I wish I'd had when I was actually searching, so like if your daughter grows up someday and decides to search or find her birth family, or even if she doesn't look for the birth family, but a lot of adoptees will like try and find out more about their culture or country of origin. And like I would say, I wish I'd had like a really good adoption competent therapist at the time. I didn't really have one. I had a really good support system, and it was really valuable. And I was writing a lot, which helped me process things. But I didn't have a counselor who had any expertise in adoption or working with adoptive families or working with adoptees. And I think it would have been great to just have that resource in addition. So, I mean, I strongly... Who amongst us would not benefit from great therapy, right? But I think it can be really especially helpful when you're going through something as like monumentally life-shifting as like a reunion with a birth family. Just a lot of things will come up, and having somebody else there who really knows a lot about adoption could be really useful.
The other one was advice for someone coming from a place where there really aren't birth records available.
Yeah,
an adult.
It's weird because there are so many different types of adoption and so many different types of adoption programs. Even here, I'm a domestic adoptee, which means I was born here in the U.S. and adopted here. And still, like, there are... I mean, those laws vary from state to state, and then, like, there are different types of adoption with different levels of openness or closure. What you can find, what you can legally access, you know, what might be on file varies so much, like state to state, like country to country, and adoptee to adoptee. So I know that just the fact that there was anything for me to find at all, I was in a very privileged position. A lot of adoptees, if they might want to search, and there might not be anything to find. If there's not, like, I think, well, just... It's not my situation, but I think I know a lot of adoptees who have kind of run into dead ends over the years looking for birth family and have learned a lot about like their culture of origin, again, or their country of origin, spent time there. Sometimes they're able to find out more about a different family member. So as opposed to a parent, maybe they find instead like a different relative. You know, that's sometimes possible, but if there really aren't like threads you can follow to specific relatives. I mean, you could see if finding out more about like if cultural exploration and really like spending more time maybe in country is useful or helpful. It might not be. It might not be a good substitute or a good thing for every adoptee. But I think that would have been, I imagine if I hadn't found anything, that would have been kind of my next step.
It was so interesting that, like, obviously so much of your search was about family, but where your book ends is really on culture mm-hmm. and on embracing that for your child and feeling, right. and you wrote there it was through family, but I could right. see that that route could take other routes. That sentence made no sense, but yeah. that you could have taken other routes there too. Yeah.
I know a lot of adult adoptees who haven't found birth family, and for a lot of them it does look like language lessons, and it does look like some of them have like taken back birth names or chosen new names, names that are reflective of their heritage. And for a lot of us, just finding like community and support with fellow adoptees is really important. I would view that as like just as important to me personally as like searching for my birth family. Yeah. You know, that's been like a really important, it's just been very important to me as an adult adoptee. And right now I hear from a lot of adoptees who've been reading the book, and that's probably been the most meaningful response so far is just, I've heard from adoptees as young as 15 and like as old as in their 70s of all races and backgrounds. And I know like we're out there and we're looking for each other. So that's been really meaningful.
There's a question here that's not for you. Okay. The question is, how many people in the audience are adopted?
You don't have to.
You don't have to raise your hand, but like if you want to, I think that's kind of cool. But nice. Awesome. That's really cool. It's really amazing that like you're giving people something to gather around with that, sense of community. I could imagine, events, book groups, all kinds of things that...
Yeah, there were probably, I think so far the largest group has been the whole crowd came to my Seattle reading, and that was really great. But there have been like several in the crowd at every reading, which thank you all so much. Mm. It's really humbling, and also like... It's like hard because I've heard from adoptees who've said like, this is the first time I've seen anything like my story in literature, and that makes me really sad.
Wow.
It's A, a lot of pressure, and B, I feel like there should be a lot more. My story is so particular. Like, it's not going to represent all of us or even most of us. It can still really mean something to people. I'm not saying like growing up as an adoptee, having a story like this would have meant a lot to me, even if it wasn't like mine. But the fact that it is such an underrepresented perspective, the fact that the adoption stories we get are by and large like not from adoptees' perspectives, especially adoptees of color, I think, it's honestly like a problem. And this book it can't address that whole void. We just need a lot more stories.
Yeah. I'm racking my brain even with fiction. Like all I'm coming up with right now is some Louise Erdrich, like there, where she deals with it from a cultural perspective really interestingly, but there's not a lot.
There's not a lot. I mean, I'm hopeful it will start to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We'll do two more short ones.
Okay.
The last ones. This person wrote to you, but I'll pick one of them, which is there's a couple that you see that seek your advice about adoption before your search for your birth family. This is early in the book. And they're basically saying, should we do it?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of interesting discussion there. What is your advice now to such couples after your search and writing your memoir? Should white people jump into adoption?
I don't think anybody should just jump in.
Well, yeah. That's
like,
not quite,
regardless of how you're becoming
that's not quite
a parent.
What they were asking you, but like, they're kind of like, is it a good idea?
This is hard. I'm asked this at every event, and I always want to just start with a disclaimer that I don't feel super qualified to give like parenting advice, as I didn't at the time. I think I was 22 mm-hmm. when I got that question from that couple. I definitely understand like where the question's coming from. I don't really view adoption as like, I write this in the book. I don't really think of it in terms, like black and white terms of like good or bad or like positive or negative, like either my own or anybody else's. I'm more interested in like, are you going into it realistically or unrealistically? Like what kind of questions are you asking yourself? If you're white and you're adopting a child of color, are you really thinking about what that child's going to experience, like within your family, within your neighborhood? What schools are they going to go to? What do your organizations, community, religious, and otherwise look like? Would a child of color be the only one or one of a few? Or would they be the only one of their background or one of a few? yeah, how are you preparing yourself to be their strongest, best ally? Because they are going to encounter racism in this country. It's just a fact. So given that their race will be relevant to them and for the rest of their life, like, are you prepared, like, to keep talking about that? And not just the fun cultural exploration parts, which of course are, like, enjoyable and, like, fun for families, and people tend to talk about that a lot more in adoption these days, which is great, cultural celebration. But, like, can you have the harder conversations? Are you going to be able to talk about white privilege and white supremacy and, like, living in a fundamentally racist society? And if you can't do that, like, maybe there's a little bit more work to do before. That's about as close as I come ever. And I think at times, honestly, one of the hardest things about writing a book like this or writing about adoption and trying to complicate a narrative that a lot of people see as very simple and very straightforward is, like, I don't really say negative things about it. I think sometimes people interpret the very fact I'm trying to complicate it and ask these questions as a negative. And it's not meant to be. I'm definitely never going to take some kind of, like, anti-adoption stand. It's not who I am. But I do think these are really important questions that, you know, people need to ask themselves, and just be realistic going in.
Okay, the last question is kind of a nice, fun one. It is, how did you decide on the book's title?
Oh, well, as you maybe could tell from the prologue, it started out just being, like, kind of just a simple quoting of that line, like, this may be all we can ever know or all you can ever know. I liked the you. I like a good, like, second person, like, pronoun in a title. It feels very welcoming, right? Like, you're all included. But then I also, you know, as I think about it more and more, I've gotten hung up on the, like, the limits of knowledge, like, what we can know. I've thought a lot about that word can, and how, you know, for so much of my childhood, again, because there were things that we didn't talk about, I would run up against that limit of, like, realistically, not just what I could know, but, like, what we could discuss and, like, what I felt able to ask. Like, there were these limits of just, like, we didn't have many facts. But then there were also different limits of like, conversation and, like, questions. So back to that theme of, like, silence, I think... So that was really where the title started to feel more real, was when I started thinking about those limits. And we all have them in our families. I think most of us, we have those things that, like, if you press too hard, people get a little awkward and weird with you. Yeah, so we know where those limits are, and I think kids are particularly good at sussing them out. So that was just kind of what I was thinking about with the title.
Yeah. All right, last question. This is your first time in Chicago. How do you like our weather?
It was, you know, it's not as bad as I was expecting. So I checked the weather forecast and I was like, that's really cold. So my new winter coat arrived just in time.
Nice.
But no, it wasn't as bad as I was expecting. I did step off the plane and for a second was like, my lungs are like, they don't feel good. This doesn't feel right. But I live in the DC area, and while it's not quite like this all the time, like, we do get down to the 20s on occasion. So,
boohoo.
I just want to say I'm super grateful it's not like negative 10, because I hear that's like a regular thing here.
Yeah.
I was like, at what temperature do you just like not go outside? Like, I guess
20 below.
There isn't one.
I guess 20 below, 10 below.
You all are amazing. You're like heroes.
We're hearty.
You are a hearty breed. That's amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week as we begin our Immigrant Heritage Month celebrations with Rebecca Dang, who shares her story as a South Sudanese refugee finding a home in the U.S. in her memoir, What They Meant for Evil. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.